Whether it's seeking overall health, improving negative symptoms, or managing weight, we are always looking for new ways to feel better and live healthier. The American Medical Association, along with many other trusted medical professionals, have found that the cornerstone of overall health is a happy, healthy gut. Gut health plays a crucial role in promoting proper digestion, enhancing immunity, and maintaining a healthy metabolism. When those elements come together, you feel better, digest properly, eliminate waste, and absorb more nutrients. Our guts affect everything from our energy levels and mood to weight management and longevity. To improve gut health, many of us have turned to probiotics or prebiotics in the hope that they will balance what is known as the gut microbiome. So what's better than prebiotics or probiotics? How about prebiotics, probiotics, and postbiotics all in one capsule? Bioma is just that. Bioma is scientifically formulated to help you rebalance your gut bacteria. To give it a try, visit gobioma.com/rain for 15% off your first order. Bioma is not a fat burner, weight loss pill, or stimulant, although one of the key ingredients has been found to reduce belly fat percentage in just 8 weeks. Just two of Bioma's delayed-release capsules before breakfast will have your gut on a reset journey. The delay ensures the probiotic actually passes through your stomach intact, delivering more active bacteria to your gut than 96% of other probiotics. Bioma is science-backed, third-party tested, and vegan. To get started on transforming your gut and overall health, visit gobioma.com/rain. That's gobioma.com/rain for 15% off your first order. Welcome back to our every other month update. Here we talk about updates to our cases, share true crime news in general, and discuss true crime stuff you might be into. So without further ado, let's get to it. And yes, my apologies. I do have a bit of a cold starting, so I don't sound my best. I know we don't often get political. Ha 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 ha. What I mean by that is we don't usually talk about things happening in the world. We do talk about the politics surrounding a case or how politics are related to failures. But we just want to say real quick, as a Portland-based show, we are not in a war zone. Portland is safe, beautiful, and it is our home. I even took my sweet, almost 70-year-old mother downtown to a protest, and it was a lovely day. We kept saying, oh, it's so nice out. What a great day to be taking a walk. So all of that's to say that ICE is not welcome here, the National Guard is not welcome here, and inspired by Hannah Einbinder, go Mariners, if by the time you hear this they're still in the series, fuck ICE and free Palestine. Josh, you have anything to add to that?
I pray for the old spaghetti factory.
May those couples that go every Wednesday afternoon still find adequate parking.
Dear Lord, let the spumoni supplies last.
That's funny because the ICE facility is basically connected to the parking lot of the old spaghetti factory downtown.
A lot of them probably go there for lunch.
Yes.
It's so close.
Yes. Walking, very much walking distance. So that's how dangerous it is. People are going to the spaghetti factory.
I always have a great time. The chairs are gigantic.
It's a goofy, huge place.
I feel like there's a portion of the restaurant that looks like a train.
I was going to say, I think there's a trolley inside, like
yeah.
Bar Rescue style. Someone came in and was like, put a trolley inside.
People will be lining up around the blocks to eat noodles in our trolley.
Emily loves Old Spaghetti Factory. I think that's the only times I've ever been is for her birthday.
It's a Portland place, right? It was founded here, I believe.
Josh, you are totally correct, and I had no idea. The first Old Spaghetti Factory opened its doors on January 10th, 1969, in the historic Carriage and Baggage Building on 2nd and Pine in Portland, Oregon.
You're welcome, ICE.
And then in 84, they moved to South Waterfront.
Little Portland history. You crack open this podcast, you're going to hear a little tale.
We're going to talk about meatballs and spaghetti.
Trolleys.
So while we're talking politics, I'll also share this news out of Washington. It took years of court battles, but finally the four names of the Seattle police officers who participated in the January 6th insurrection against our country have been named. Married officers Alexander Everett and Caitlin Rochelle Everett were identified earlier, and they have both been fired.
It was their honeymoon.
They were just sightseeing. Sergeant Jacob Brisky remains on the force, and in 2020, he made over $175,000. Sergeant Scotty Bach doesn't appear to be on the Seattle PD anymore, and in 2020, he made nearly $225,000. Detective Michael Settle, who appears to be on the force, but may kind of be in an HR capacity or at his desk, he was paid $145,000 in 2020. And Officer Jason Marchioni, who also appears to still be on the force, he was paid $146,000 in 2020. Just wanted to make sure those names were out there. And if you're in Seattle, keep a lookout for these treasonous guys.
So glad to have them in law enforcement.
I feel like they're really good at decision making.
Mm-hmm.
So
critical thinking and looking at people as people.
Well, and following the Constitution and laws and understanding all
which
that.
Which I think is in the, yeah, they're supposed to enforce.
Yeah.
But instead they were going to hang Mike Pence. Huh.
You're confused. It's fine.
I think I'm dumb.
So speaking of being dumb and for looking out for things while you're in Washington, we do have an update to Josh's episode, This Little Piece of the Devil, which told the story of how horrendous the crimes of South Hill rapist Kevin Coe were. So here's a very brief recap. It's kind of hard to know where to start as his crimes warranted a two-part episode, but we'll give you some info. So from 1978 to 1981, the South Hill rapist, who disguised himself as a jogger, raped, assaulted, groped, and flashed dozens of women across one posh Spokane, Washington neighborhood. After a car belonging to his father, Gordon, was spotted illegally parked at a junior high running track at the time one of the rapes took place, it was traced back to his son, Frederick Harlan Coe. This connection, along with strong identifications of Coe from many of those attacked, resulted in his arrest for the South Hill rapes. And though it seemed to be an open and shut case, the crimes of Fred Coe would later be brought back to court again and again and again. As a reminder of just how horrible his crimes were, it was believed Kevin Coe was responsible for up to 40 rapes. His MO included smelling like pungent soap, asking personal questions about the victims' lives and sometimes of a sexual nature, threatening to kill them, threatening to kill their family members, beating victims nearly to death, and something I definitely remember from you telling this story, Josh, was the shoving his gloved hand down their throats.
That was my first memory when you said his name.
On October 2nd of this year, so just a couple weeks ago, a hearing was scheduled which allowed Coe's victims to make statements regarding his possible release. While the victims were allowed to speak, they didn't get to say anything to Coe directly as he didn't appear in court or on video and he wasn't required to do so. Some of the survivors' statements were, quote, "You gave me a life sentence. The fear will never go away. I was just a young adult, and you destroyed over 40 years of my life." Another victim said, "45 years of your life. You go through everything again. It's a re-rape, because when you were raped, the minute you get up and you walk home, your survival days begin." Another survivor said, "I wish I could have done this years ago, but it has been many years. I have seen more and know more, and I can sure as hell say more. And I wish you were dead."
He was a real weirdo. I remember when he went to court, finally, Kevin Coe.
Mm-hmm.
He would wear tailored three-piece suits. He had his hair coiffed by blow dryer. And he wore stage makeup.
Oh, I forgot about the stage makeup.
He was trying to present himself sort of Bundy-like, I believe, as a lawyer, even though he was not. I feel like he was nothing career-wise.
Another victim said, quote, "He will never be free. I would ask those still hurting to remember you are a survivor. Jesus is with you. And with that in your life, Satan will never win. The same is with Fred Coe. He will never win. I have trouble talking to men in particular. I have very little trust in humanity or human beings," said a different 67-year-old survivor. "You have made me a shell with nothing inside me but darkness. You beat me up. You made me answer questions about my family, my child. And then you threatened to kill me and my family if I turned you in. How dare you breathe the air we breathe? It's not fair. It's not fair to me. You take up space, space that you don't need, space that you are not supposed to have. I was a victim of a violent rape perpetrated by Fred Harlan Kevin Coe. As I headed home to shower, I remember crying out to Father God, asking him to forgive the man." So very long story shorter, Ko was eventually sentenced to life plus 55 years. He served 25 years at Walla Walla State, where he participated in zero treatment programs or rehabilitation. He was then transferred to McNeil Island and has spent the last almost 20 years there. Even though he was eligible for parole long ago, he did not seek it. Now, the 77-year-old, who has had a stroke, heart failure, degenerative disc disease, and dehydration, has been released as he is no longer deemed a threat, and he continues to deny any responsibility for any of the rapes. You know, Josh, if only there were other cases we could learn from to not do such a thing. Richard Gilmore and a million others. So as of early October, Kevin Ko has been released and he will be living in an adult home in Federal Way, Washington. Spokane County Deputy Prosecutor Preston McCollum said, "In this situation, he is released without ever acknowledging guilt or ever completing treatment. I personally believe unless he changes his ways, he will spend an eternity surrounded by flames."
I believe he served out his sentence. And when he was transferred to McNeil Island, it was civil commitment. They had nowhere else to put him. And so they were keeping him there. And I remember reading something a few years ago about that. They did not know what to do with him.
They just aged him out, apparently.
How old is he now?
77.
That's not, I mean, that is old.
And he does have health issues.
Yeah.
So we can hope that he really is unwell and frail and can just go to this adult home and
just waste away.
Waste away.
Yeah. Goodbye, Kevin.
So heads up, if you're in Federal Way, he's just out and about, no monitoring, no nothing. So who knows what kind of condition he's in.
And as if a person like that, if they weren't able to still do the same thing they did that got them in prison, they can do a variation on that theme and hurt a lot of people still.
Call the victims, show up at their work.
Oh, I just meant strangers on the street.
Oh, yeah.
Children, girls, whoever. I mean, it's.
And
yeah.
I'm sorry if we're worried about.
He's free.
We're worried about room in a prison. Do we not have people on like low level drug charges that maybe got 5 years, not the dude with life plus 55?
Yeah, they could let out a bunch of people and
could you
pass
really
the savings on to him.
Right? Mm-hmm. Couldn't we release everyone with any kind of marijuana charge and have so much room?
And tell me how to get hooked up. I need some bargain basement weed prices.
So heads up in Federal Way, you've got another just gem of a person wandering around. Last March, I released the two-part episode, The Murder of Barbara Jean Hagedorn, Parts 1 and 2. It was a highlight of my work with the show as Barbara's son, Patrick, had reached out to us asking to cover the story of his mother's murder. He had never told the story and was ready to share it, not only for his own healing, but to help others who may have felt similarly. He reached out to me over the last few weeks with not only updates to his personal life, but to a case within the episode. So first, the episode update. Within that episode, we discussed the murder of Nicholas Vallison. Here is some backstory. On September 21st, 2023, Nick left his home at 7:20 a.m. for his morning walk with Nanook, his dog. His wife was leaving at the same time, and as she got to the bottom of their neighborhood hill, she saw something out of place. It was a U-Haul truck. Tanny, Nick's wife, called him and a neighbor, asking that they go inspect the situation. This may seem like an unexpected reaction, but there had been issues in the area related to illegal dumping, and it appeared that that was what was taking place. Nick heeded his wife's call and changed direction, heading for the U-Haul's location. Alyssa Montano, a woman connected to a man named Andrew Ralph Bame, told police that Andrew stated he needed to get to Ravensdale. Andrew had stolen a U-Haul with a bunch of property in the back, which he wanted to go through. So Alyssa, Andrew, and a second man, Bart McCurry, drove their vehicles, including the U-Haul and a Dodge pickup, to a secluded area, which happened to be the end of that hill. As they were going through the truck, there was banging on the side of the wall. It was Nick. Exiting the U-Haul, the group approached him. He was filming and asked them what they were doing. He also informed them police had been called and were on their way. When the group was confronted, they left the U-Haul and went to the pickup they had brought along with them. They attempted to leave, but it's believed Nick was trying to stop their escape by moving a log in the path of the pickup. Prosecutors would later say it was possible that while moving the log, Nick tripped and fell. Andrew, who had already been revving the truck's engine in hopes of intimidating Nick, well, it didn't work, but when he fell, Andrew hit the gas and drove over Nick as he lay on the ground. Tanny, Nick's wife, started calling his cell to see how it was going, but he didn't answer. Again and again she called, but nothing. Worried, she turned back after dropping their daughter off at school and returned home. But before she could get there, she came upon a grisly scene. Her husband, in the road, dying from severe head injuries and blunt force trauma. Prior to her arrival, a neighbor encountered the situation and also tried to help, but the truck's tire had run over Nick's head and he was declared dead at the scene. Since whoever had done this were strangers to the neighborhood, there was an urgent search for who could have committed such a senseless act. Interviewing witnesses, it was reported that a black or dark gray older Dodge Ram had been seen speeding through the area around the time of the murder. It didn't take long for detectives in the area to find the U-Haul. It was only 50 yards away in a wooded area surrounded by items and garbage. That afternoon, the truck was reported stolen. Later that same day, calls came in about popping sounds and smoke. In a wooded area just 5 miles from where Nick had been killed, a pickup was found engulfed in flames. Enough of the truck was left after the fire to learn that it had been stolen back in June and it matched the description of the one seen fleeing the area. 2 days later, Andrew Baim was arrested, but not for the murder, for failing to register as a sex offender, a different stolen vehicle case, and unrelated warrants. He was released on bond October 15th. It would take until November 15th for detectives to piece together the stolen trucks, the paperwork, which included the names of those who had actually rented the truck and other documents showing Andrew's name, and there was enough evidence that led to the arrest of 38-year-old Andrew Baim. Now for the update. In early September of this year, now 39-year-old Andrew Baim was found guilty of second-degree murder, second-degree arson, and possession of a stolen vehicle in connection with the death of Nick Valson. He was found not guilty of intentional murder. Basically, the verdict meant it wasn't believed Andrew went out of his way to kill Nick, but accidentally did while committing another felony. The defense's argument that this was an unfortunate accident did not work. Tanny, Nick's widow, said, quote, "My husband Nick was an honorable man. He is loved and missed every single day. And with this verdict, we can continue to honor him while also knowing that the person who took him from this world will face true accountability." And now for the personal update from Patrick. First of all, Patrick's mother's best friend, who took care of him after her murder, heard the show and was then able to find Patrick on Facebook. She even sent a photo of him with his mother that was taken just a few days before she was killed, which he had never seen before. On the recent anniversary of his mother's death, Patrick went to Longview and saw that friend after many years. They discussed memories and details that neither had heard before. He's also been connected with other people in his life from that time. Patrick said, quote, "Words can't explain how this meeting has made us feel and the amount of healing it has caused, and it's because of you all." And this just means so much to us, Patrick. In the 6.5 years of doing this show, helping survivors and those affected by loss has been the goal. And so to know that we had even the tiniest part of him reconnecting with those people and just to see that photo of his mother, it really means the world, and we are so honored to have been chosen to have any part of telling his story, and we hope that this brings nothing but the best for Patrick and his loved ones and everyone he's reconnecting with.
Yeah, a little bit of peace, a little bit of a connection.
Yeah.
An old friend. Yeah. It's hard for me to talk about it because it makes me very emotional.
Well, yeah, it's like
I'm so glad that that happened for him.
It's like he's getting his family back.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's very... very cool, very meaningful. It means a lot. Back in 2022, we aired a special episode about missing Blue River man Shane Springer. Here's a little backstory before the update. 47-year-old Shane Springer was last seen at work in Vida, Oregon, an unincorporated area of Lane County, Oregon. Around 10 a.m. on November 2nd, 2021, Shane left the construction site where he was working, his power tools plugged in and ready to go upon his presumably swift return, but he never came back. 3 days later, his truck was located near the Blue River Reservoir. Shane's family was certain Shane was not distraught or that he would have left without informing anyone. Shane was excitedly working on rebuilding his home, which had been destroyed in the Holiday Farm fire in September of 2020. At the time of his disappearance, Shane was 47 years old, a white male, 6'1", 175 pounds, with brown receding hair. He had hazel eyes and a short beard and used reading glasses. When he went missing, he was wearing a camo jacket and dark work pants. So that's a very little bit of Shane's story. If you've been listening to our updates for a while, you'll know that in late of 2022, some of Shane's remains were recovered from where he had gone missing. There haven't been details released as far as what or how much of Shane was found at that time. The update we have today continues to be a bittersweet one. On June 27th, it was announced that additional partial remains of Shane had been discovered off Quartz Creek Road, just about 5 miles southwest of where his truck was discovered 4 years ago. The news broke this year, but the bone fragments that were recovered from the Mackenzie River had been found in 2023. The major backlog and understaffing at the Oregon Crime Lab led to a nonprofit stepping in to fund the testing for the fragments at a private lab. The results came back as a DNA match for Shane. My heart goes out to the family for so many reasons. Shane missing for so long, hearing that bones were found, then having to wait 2 years for confirmation. It's just a horrible situation. Candace Cooley, founder of Dylan's Legacy, the nonprofit that assisted in the financial backing of the identification, said this after the confirmation. Quote, "This is welcomed news that the family has been waiting for. Every little piece of a case found is just like a puzzle piece that has been lost. This particular piece has caused much controversy, being a cranium fragment and not being tested until I got involved." The circumstances surrounding Shane's disappearance remain suspicious. Because it's unclear what Shane's cause of death was, did he fall while mushrooming? Was he harmed by those he had confronted? Foul play cannot be ruled out. To support Shane's family and stay up to date on case information, you can join the Missing in Blue River, Oregon area Find Shane Springer Facebook group. If you have any information about Shane's disappearance, no matter how trivial you think it may be, you are asked to contact the Lane County Sheriff's Office at 541-682-4150 and reference case number 21-6268. And you can always leave an anonymous tip at crimestoppersoforegon.com. I'm hoping this next story gets to Tiger King and Chimp Crazy director Eric Good. It would probably make for a pretty good documentary.
Ah?
Get it? Good? Good?
Eric?
Located off Highway 101, not far from Bandon, Oregon, was the walkthrough West Coast Game Park Safari. It opened all the way back in 1968, and it was exactly what you would expect for a tourist trap of the animal nature. And for anyone that doesn't know, Highway 101 is our coastal highway. So Bandon is a coastal area.
And all that entails.
Yes. I'll leave it. We don't call it the beach, baby. We call it the coast. Different.
People are living on taffy out there.
So much salt. This place wasn't so much a safari as it was a petting zoo and captive breeding program, which was not accredited. Like how Joe Exotic bred and sold big cats to other similar programs, West Coast Game Park Safari did the same. Some of their more notable animals were emus, cougars, capybaras, lions, tigers, and not bears, but snow leopards. Oh, and also bears. In 2015 and 16, they faced USDA violations, including but not limited to the mishandling of animals of all ages, shooting 2 bears, dead, sick, and starving animals on the property, animals that had never been seen by a veterinarian, rat droppings, rotting food, and storing a deceased tiger for months in a food container in a freezer.
USDA, I think of policing the quality of foods and meats. Am I wrong about that?
I believe that is part of it.
But they also are animal.
They're the agriculture. So
oh,
I think it's
breeding of big
animals.
And
yeah.
I see.
Yeah. So the agriculture part is where they
what
come
is that stand? U.S. Oh,
United
Department of Agriculture.
States Department of Agriculture.
I was like, what is the D?
Is the
it's
D?
Always department.
Give me that D.
Give me that department.
So you would think back 10 years ago when they found the dead tiger in a storage container in a freezer, they would have shut them down, but no.
Is that illegal?
I just, I think if you're touting yourself as a tourist location that cares for animals, you should probably properly dispose of
That's a good attraction, animals. Though.
Well, that wasn't part of the attraction. They weren't showing people the dead tiger, I don't think.
They were showing some people the dead tiger.
Yeah, I bet some people paid. They were like, yeah. I hear you got a tiger.
Can you get that out of the freezer? I just want to lay down on it like Sam Neill in Jurassic Park on that Triceratops. Yeah, I know it won't be breathing. Huh? Do I mention that scene too often?
Never.
Pretty often, though. Squeezing those things on its tongue? Ew.
Their history of poor care landed them on PETA's hellhole list of tourist attractions, which then led to a raid of the property in May of this year. After 3 days of raiding the business, Brian Scott Tenney, the 53-year-old owner of the park, was arraigned on August 25th. Among the 371 charges Brian Tenney faces are unlawful possession of wildlife, failure to meet requirements of care of wildlife held in captivity, first and second degree animal neglect, racketeering, possession and delivery of drugs, possession of a machine gun, and reckless endangerment. So part of the reason that there are over 300 charges is that each animal was represented.
Yay.
I know, isn't that so cool?
Yeah, I was hoping that was why.
So some of those animals include 9 porcupines, 5 camels, 4 lions, and over 100 sheep. The other reason for so many charges is there were a lot of drugs and firearms, including 44 guns, almost 90 grams of meth, 8 grams of cocaine, $1.6 million in cash, bonds, proof of manufacturing, and distributing drugs.
Oh, so there was more.
There was more.
It wasn't just the animals. The animals it's may almost have been like an offshoot of the meth.
It might have been that the animals were a cover-up and or a way to launder money through
Well, that's
the meth.
A horrible way to launder money. I guess it's maybe okay to launder drug money into illegal animal money?
You know what? I'm telling you, if you're going eccentric, drugged, wacko, why not go full big animals? You know, go full Tiger King if you're going to do it.
He was on meth, wasn't he?
I believe so. I think that was part of the issue.
And I feel like Chimp Crazy Lady was on pills at least.
She was on something.
Yeah.
So, yes, there. If anyone is looking for a thesis topic, perhaps the correlation between drug manufacturing and usage and big animals.
I mean, you need space, too, so it's probably not going to happen in your major cities.
Right. Yeah, we're talking a little more secluded. So in total, 310 animals were rescued from the park and they were relocated, and only 3 had to be euthanized. So the good news is that this monster, Brian Tenney, will no longer be able to hurt any animals. This is why it is so important that you check into the history or read reviews of places that have animals. Maybe you feel really strongly and you don't think animals should be kept in these kinds of places at all. Maybe you like to go to places like this. Just do a little bit of homework to make sure that your money isn't actually going into the drug trade and that the animals are being cared for properly. So we will keep you updated if there ends up being a trial or a plea deal. And I'm sorry to not be innocent until proven guilty, but, you know, we're waiting to hear some sentencing for Brian. I don't think he's going to get out of this one. We here at Murder in the Rain are so excited, elated, overjoyed to say that we are sponsored by newspapers.com, our favorite website. Well, in general, I would say. Josh, what are your thoughts, feelings, and opinions about newspapers.com?
I use it every day. I love it every time I use it. It's easy.
We do use it every day. And if you've been to our blog at murderintherain.com, you will see that almost every source that we put is through newspapers.com. I've used it for background checks for people in my life or stories that we're covering. I've even looked up my own family members, my friends, or local history. If you're curious about your own community or city, you can just look it up by the city. You can look up maybe what happened on your birthday across the country or in your state. There are so many varieties to the search filters that you can really narrow down and get real nitty gritty.
You know, I just finished reading that book, The Ruin of All Witches, about a real witch panic that happened in Springfield, Massachusetts in the 1640s and 50s. If the newspapers.com newspapers go all the way back to that time, I'm going to look those names up. I'm very interested in that. I would love to read about witchcraft and those trials. And I mean, they were.
And how it was reported to the public.
Yes, yeah. As actual things.
To get started on your own newspapers.com journey, go to newspapers.com/crime. When you sign up, use discount code MURDERINTHERAIN to get 20% off. We dare you to sign up, look up a date, a location, a famous crime, or a person, and just try to not spiral for the rest of the day. That's newspapers.com/crime using discount code MURDERINTHERAIN. So let's lighten the mood a little with kind of a tease of what we've been doing over on Patreon, which includes our new segment, Hot Streamers. So we've only done it once, but we will be doing it more, and we do need to talk about some Halloween things that we're watching.
Great.
But for now, some of the true crime or true crime adjacent things we've watched as of late are Lords of Tupelo. Tupelo? How do you say?
Kings of Tupelo.
It's not Lords?
No.
Shit.
Accurate is what we are.
Tupelo.
T-U-P-E-L-O. Birthplace of Elvis, baby. How do you not know that? Oh.
So one that we've watched is Kings of Tupelo. Netflix. It was great. It was wild. Very Tiger King, I would say.
Oh, that's the one where the guy finds body parts in a hospital.
It's the conspiracy, but then it's not a conspiracy, but then it is a conspiracy, but then it's covering up all the actual real bad stuff that's happening.
But it wasn't.
It was wild.
It was wild.
So that was a fascinating look at a conspiracy theory psyche.
That one mortician guy who was sort of like the actual King of Tupelo.
Uh-huh.
He was great and charming, and I loved him. And he was arrogant, very full of himself, and you know, but in a good way, I think.
Yes, a necessary way.
And he was a little guy.
We finally saw the Oscar-nominated and I think Oscar-winning Anatomy of a Fall.
The dog won something.
our hearts.
Yeah. Best dog performance I've ever seen. There is a minute in that movie that is heart-stopping because of that dog's acting.
Yes.
You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Whoa, man.
Yeah.
Whoa.
So that was excellent, and it's really more of a, it's not true crime, it's just a film, but it's really more how people handle things and how things are perceived. And
what the truth is
right
and, to each other and what truth actually is.
Mm-hmm. And does acquittal mean not guilty, and does guilty mean guilty? It's a lot. It was a thinker. It was excellent.
Yeah.
Then we finally gave in. I know we're months behind the trend, which is right on time for us. We were like, you know what, let's try Monsters, the Menendez brothers. And I gotta say, I was shocked at how watchable it was, because I don't trust Ryan Murphy. He is salacious and exploitive.
Extremely hit or miss.
Obviously, everything was taken with a grain of salt, and we would look things up to go, did that actually happen? And I know people are taking the same issue with the Ed Gein story. Oh, you know, there's the sexual elements, or we don't really know, or it's trying to paint these people in a different light. And you and I have talked about this where, yes, they're showing Ed Gein, or they showed the Menendez brothers, where you're like, oh, my heart actually hurts for them, because if this is true, all this background doesn't undo what they did, doesn't make it okay.
It can still be sad and heartbreaking.
Yeah, and it's important to have those now, because if our goal as a society is to stop monsters, we need to know what makes monsters.
And that they are just people.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. They just do extreme things.
Yeah.
But I thought the Menendez series was really great at portraying various types of abuse and how it was discussed and how someone would react in life to that. I thought it was beautiful at times, the way that they were able to address that.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was very interesting, and a grain of salt the size of a very large boulder.
also the cast of Monster, the two leads in that show are, I don't know, infinitely better looking or hotter.
Yes.
It's more a dig on the show where I wish they'd gone a little more with reality.
Well, that's really the Ryan Murphy effect. He likes bright, shiny. His newest one is Kim Kardashian as the lead. Like, that's... He doesn't like
what
the
uglies.
What is
that, Monster, the Robert Kardashian story?
Oh, got her. Got her. Got her. And I would say maybe our favorite documentary of the year, Furry Detectives.
You mean with Detective Patch O'Fur?
That's right.
That was one of the best series I've ever seen. It was like Don't Fuck with Cats.
Yes. I don't remember where it was. Do you?
Sundance.
Sundance. Okay.
If you have AMC Plus, I think you can get it.
It was superb, but I will warn anyone ahead of time that the focus is animal abuse. They are very cautious. It's definitely made by people who love animals. So they don't show anything. They literally beep descriptions of acts that happen. But it is about the furry community. Yes, that furry community. And how they started learning about actual animal abuse within. So kind of this like offset branch of furries. And they were like, well, the cops aren't doing anything.
The dark furries, like a dark web mm-hmm. furry.
Yes, exactly. And they take it into their own paws and track these people down. And it's incredible. And I have so much respect for all of them. And it totally changed my perspective of furries. Everyone involved was rad. And I might do an episode because some stuff happened in Oregon and there were such cool people. I really just want to talk to them.
Yeah, they were real heroes, really brave to absorb the things they had to absorb to put a target on this person.
Yeah, to be passionate about loving animals and then having to watch the worst things you can imagine. And also the trolling and the threats and the... That's probably my favorite documentary of the year.
It was a stunner. It was only 4 episodes, I think.
Oh, was it really?
I think so. Maybe it was 5 or 6.
But still, it
went by so quickly and was so well made. And it was funny, too. They did a lot of shots of patches of fur in the trench coat doing like working on a computer. And it was a shot they would cut to all the time.
His little over the shoulder.
Yeah, he would quickly,
dramatic
look, quickly look over the shoulder. Oh, my God. They played it all the time. It was funny every time.
I want that on a shirt.
Yeah.
Him looking over the shoulder.
Yes. Patches is watching, or Patch. I can't remember. Patch
if you if you're making merch, please let me buy a shirt from you.
Yeah.
Please sign it. For this next segment, let's head to Josh's Library Corner. And in this episode, he's discussing one of his newest reads and newest favorites, it's been sounding like. Heart is a Chainsaw.
My Heart is a Chainsaw.
My Heart is a Chainsaw.
It's the first book in a trilogy, the Indian Lake Trilogy by Stephen Graham Jones. One of the best horror series, one of the best books, one of the best everythings I've ever read. If you're a horror fan, if you're a slasher fan, and if you like movies like Scream, that series, this is kind of like that. It's about a high school girl who's an outcast who essentially finds out that she's in a slasher movie, which is what she's always wanted.
But
it's much different than you think. And as the books go on, the 3 books, the story grows and becomes quite meaningful. And it's very well-rounded, very scary, very funny and clever. And it has hundreds, thousands of references to horror movies. And they're all cool.
I was going to say,
I feel like
your biggest takeaway that I've noticed from it was just how many references were made that you were either like, oh my God, I can't believe any other human being knows that movie, or wow, I don't even know what they're talking about. We have to look that up.
Yeah, it really expanded the things I want to look at. Like Bay of Blood is supposed to be awesome. Haven't seen it yet, but it's like the central movie in that series. It gets talked about all the time. So yeah, it was great. Very educational. It taught me a lot about writing. And more than anything, it taught me that it's okay that the way I express myself and write is through movie references and pop culture things and, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
That's part of my way of expression. And that's what My Heart is a Chainsaw, I believe, means, is that like that's my heart is that. And it's okay that I like those things, that I seek those things out. You know, you look into the darkness a lot. And I like that. I liked hearing that written about. It was great.
That was really beautiful.
Thank you.
That was a lovely description.
Yeah, it was awesome. I really admire his writing. He's just the coolest dude, the coolest writer.
And what's his name?
Stephen Graham Jones.
Stephen Graham Jones. So My Heart is a Chainsaw, Stephen Graham Jones. Of course, we always recommend you go through Thrift Books or
Bookshop.org.
Bookshop or Books a Million, or go to your local bookstore. And if they don't have it, you can always ask them to order it and they will do that for you. And it's usually at a lower cost than if you just bought it. So, you know, keep it local, baby. My Heart is a Chainsaw. You give it how many chainsaws?
Or I give it 13 chainsaws.
Out of
13.
Oh my gosh. A perfect score. And that was Josh's Library
Cover. I couldn't remember what it was. I thought it was Reading Corner.
Perfect.
Well.
This next one is a warning to all the ladies in case you were very silly and you felt safe for even a brief moment. In 2016, Christian Sayer purchased the historic Anchor Pub in Everett, Washington. For those not familiar, Everett is about 30 miles north of Seattle. In 2020, a woman reported being the victim of sexual assault and her case connected back to the pub. A year later, DNA from that victim was linked to Christian, the owner. This led to search warrants and testing, which proved the DNA was a match, which was found in the 2020 case. This led to a more expansive investigation, which sadly found more victims, and not just a couple, dozens. When speaking with those victims, a pattern revealed itself. The women would go to the pub, only have a few drinks, but would have no recollection of what occurred afterward. When they woke up, they were confused, but knew they had been assaulted. Starting with the cases they were sure of, Christian was arrested in 2021 for 2 counts of rape and 1 count of indecent liberties. Even with the arrest, the investigation went on. What they learned was horrific. Men and women came forward to say they had all been victimized by Christian. The claims went back as far as 20 years. The search warrants led to a notebook with over 30 names listed. Some names were known as they were reported assaults in 2001. They also recovered a hard drive with child sex abuse materials. Compiling everything, Christian Sayer was charged with over 20 felonies in Snohomish County and 8 felonies in Washington County, Oregon, where he had lived previously. The combination of charges and locations led to 4 trials, which came to an end this last May. Christian Sayer was found guilty of 16 felony charges, including but not limited to indecent liberties involving adults and minors and multiple counts of rape. For the later charges, when he owned the pub, it was found that part of his MO was to spike the drinks of customers before he assaulted them. For his multi-decade reign of terror and trail of dozens of victims, Christian Sayer was sentenced. You want to take a guess, Josh?
6 years.
That's a very good guess for the history of cases we have covered. He was sentenced to 109 years.
Yeah!
Ba-ba-da-ba-ba-ba-ba! A good sentence.
Get the good justice system bell going.
That's right. Ding, ding, ding.
The Liberty Bell, perhaps.
Everett Police Chief John DeRouse said, "This is one of the most complex and disturbing cases our department has handled, and I want to commend our entire team, along with our regional partners, for their exceptional professionalism and dedication. Above all, I want to thank the survivors for their courage." A detective on the case added, "The bravery of the survivors who came forward to share their trauma and experiences brought justice for the egregious sexual assaults committed by Christian Sayer. There is no doubt that their courage put an end to Sayer's continuing his predatory behavior in this community. The extensive work done by Leeds Snohomish County Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Martha Saccarino and Deputy Prosecutor Kara Van Slick in these trials was remarkable." In 2024, the Anchor Pub was reopened under a different name by a new owner, Shane Radigan, who said, "We respect that there's a lot of people that have some, I'm sure, really bad memories and bad connections with that operation. But it's important for us to remind people that the building is not at fault. It's a really wonderful place to have a bar. We can't ignore it. We have to own it to some degree. What our message is, we really believe in Everett. We believe in this location. We think it's got a lot of potential. We're going to do our best to bring that positivity to the place that we've done at Pinehurst. Try to turn the page without ignoring what went down. So there you go. Even the bartender, who's supposed to be the guy that I can like give a signal to and he'll make the annoying guy go away or ask for help or whatever. Nope. He's the one doing it.
And he's a pedophile.
Yep. But 109 years. And he's young. So he started, I think, in his late teens. Because he's, I think, not even 40.
Wow.
And it was 20 years they were able to go back.
Someday we'll be telling us a report about him being released from McNeil Island as an old sick man.
Or in about 15 years when they go, he's fine. He said he was sorry.
He hasn't done anything like that here.
Yeah, he's nice to everybody.
He's in full remission as long as he's not around anyone who's not an inmate.
Yeah, he's fine. Don't do it, Washington. Let him rot in prison. Thank you. Now for something completely petty. About 7 weeks ago, my mom and I were rear-ended. We were sitting at a light on a freeway off-ramp. Mom was talking about how she sounds like Madonna when she's singing, but only if she's alone in her car. And we were giggling, having a great time, when boom! Luckily, there were no airbags, which we're thankful for, even though we were not only hit in the rear, but then thrown into the truck in front of us. I'm not going to go into all the details about how I yelled at this man who hit us, who claimed that his brakes went out in his Audi. Okay. The truck in front of us left to go to the hospital because his son's neck was hurt. And he was like, oh, my son's in the car. He's 27. It's not like a kid, but he does not cry. And he's crying because of his neck. So we have to go. And as far as I know, he's okay. I immediately had a pounding headache. I was pretty sure that I had some sort of mild concussion. And my mom was in total shock. She was just wandering around. She had already taken her shoes off in the car, apparently, and she was just out walking in the debris. And I was like, you need to go sit down. It was her first big car accident. I'm not a rookie. I'm an old timer. This is old news for me, but this was all new for her. So she was totally in shock. And we are both okay. We're getting our medical treatment, you know, the massage therapy and the chiropractic and all of that. And it was just a vehicle and everything could have been so much worse. So we are so grateful for all of that. Eventually, the police arrived, and that was when we learned that this piece of shit did not have a license or insurance, an issue that I have dealt with in many accidents previously.
Because you don't have those things.
Yes, I don't bother with those.
No, no, no. That's for other people.
So this news led to more stern language toward this guy, who also had the nerve to apologize for the accident when I informed him, in a tone reserved for the Jerry Springer show, that it's not an accident to get behind the wheel without insurance or license. So you know that saying that you'll pass or interact with X number of murderers in your life? Well, I was so pissed at this bastard for hurting my mom that I came home and I gave him the old murder in the rain research treatment.
Which is a full press.
I didn't go into ancestry, but I found what I could.
We dig.
And this is all publicly available information, so no allegations here, just facts. And because I have a show and I can talk about whatever I want to publicly call out the selfish and dangerous choices of this man, as maybe you're his neighbor, and you should know that he is reckless and thoughtless. His name is Patrick Allen Sparks. He's 61 years old, and he lives in Portland. When he was 18, he was given 2 years probation for driving with a revoked license. That's right. He's been doing this shit since he was 18 back in 1981. In 84, the charge was forgery. In 90, we're back to driving while suspended. 91, another driving while suspended. Also in 91, he was charged with theft in the second degree. The next year, he upped it to assault in the first degree. 1993 saw him with unauthorized use of a vehicle, assault in the first degree, and the big one, a charge of attempt to commit murder. Not sure how long he got for that one, but he stayed out of trouble until 2008 and 2010 when he was busted twice again for driving while suspended. His tags were expired in 2011 and 2014. Between those offenses, he was charged with harassment in 2013. His latest was in 2014 when he was charged with attempting to commit a Class B felony. That was related to a domestic violence charge, and while he was in jail for that charge, he called the witness he was ordered to have no contact with 52 times. During those calls, he begged his victim not to show up to court and also to lie to any officers if they asked about him contacting her. So all in all, He's a really great guy. So yeah, you never know when a guy who has been charged with attempted murder will total your SUV, then whimper about how sorry he is. One of the worst parts was watching the reality of the criminal justice system hit my mother. She said to the cop, "Well, at least you'll be taking him away." I guffawed. The officer made a face. Then we both explained to her that those are only ticketable offenses, not arrestable ones, leaving us wondering, why is it we both pay more than a car payment for our car insurance to cover uninsured drivers, and then we also pay for our license and our tags, when jerks like Patrick Sparks can just go their whole lives getting little citations while destroying cars and burdening others? Thank you for listening. I know this is more of a cathartic part of my PTSD processing. This was one of many car accidents in my life and one of many with an uninsured driver. So I appreciate you listening to my little tattle and my processing. Patrick, I hope you hear this. I hope you feel some little shred of shame and responsibility. And I hope your life is as good to you as you have been to others. So that's it for this update. We'll have another one in a few weeks. And our next episode, which might end up being two episodes, I will be covering the baffling and bizarre disappearance of Kristen Tomlin. If you'd like to get a leg up on the story, you can read the book Kristen, Can You Hear Me? By Teresa Letcher. And then you'll have all the inside info before we get to that case.
That's a bonkers one.
That's an understatement.
Yeah.
So there you go. Happy Halloween. Happy Thanksgiving if we're not back by then for an update. I haven't looked at the calendar. It'll be close.
Come on, go, go, go. Come on, come on, come on.
It's turkey time.
Spooky.
Okay, let me see. I'm looking this up because that would be incredible.
I'm at almost 100% certainty on this. My levels are peaking. If I'm wrong, it's going to be bad.
You know, I looked up the only difference between COVID and cold is the sneezing. So there you go.
And Gosh. That and that one exists and the other does not.
One has a vaccine. Uh-oh. Did you have a vaccine is why that's happening?
Yeah, I know. I was struck by lightning.
The first old spaghetti factory opened its doors.
I'm so sorry. So sorry. So sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
Degradation or something.
Degradation.
Degradation. Or a different kind of whatever. I'm cutting that. I can't today. I'm grabbing your balls from the inside. That's what I'm doing. The major backlog and understaffing at the Oregon crime.
Sorry about that.
Crime-related things we've watched as of late war. As of late war?
That'd be cool to see an actual 100-year-plus sentence and the man live through it.
Ooh, is that our sci-fi movie as we invent mortality,
you serve your sentence?
But extended mortality. Yeah. So like if you got prisoners? 250 years, you have to spend the 250 years.
Wow.
That'd be cool.
And that would be, that'd be a far worse punishment. Wow, yeah. That's good. Let's write that down. Actually, maybe we shouldn't put this out.
I'm not. This is for us. Trademark, copyright.
Trademark, copyright. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Patent pending.
Well, aging is terrible. Prison is terrible.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be like, oh, I'm young forever. It's like you're 200 years old.
Yeah.
But you're still alive.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, I'm dusty.